When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 140. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm absolutely thrilled to be heading down to Essex to talk to farmer, fellow podcaster, blogger, and all-round Renaissance man, Ben Eagle. Ben, how are you?
Oh, I am very well, Will. Thank you. I'm even better for that introduction. That has bigged my ego up. No.
What does it feel like to be at the receiving end of a podcast interview for once?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had the great pleasure to interview you back in the autumn, yeah. And you were telling me then quite how strange it is to be on the receiving end, and I completely agree. I still have lots of questions in my mind for you, which I'm sort of trying to hold back from asking you. But, yeah.
It's much easier asking questions than answering them, I think, isn't it? It's just
I will find out.
Yeah. So it is now 1st of June 2020. We're in the middle of I'm always a bit reticent to say a drought in the UK because, you know, farmers in Australia are always kind of laugh at you when you say that. But nevertheless, it is very dry. We haven't had any rain for a couple of months and the crops aren't looking great. You are in the driest part of the UK, famously down there. How are you coping with it?
I think we're definitely not at crisis point. Mm-hmm. And I think even where we are, we still had a fairly wet winter. Mm-hmm. Let's say that, like everyone else, pretty much, we're just a lot of spring cropping here. Mm. And with that, with very little moisture in the soil, that is going to struggle. And we will see how that turns out at harvest and date of harvest, especially with straw as well. But there's also the people factors, which in Essex we always have to think about, because we have lots of people here. Mm-hmm. And one of those is definitely fire. I think we've had probably three or four barbecues on the edges of fields last couple of weeks,
right,
which have had to be extinguished, and various things like that. And yeah, just grass not growing. But it's yeah, you sort of live with it in this part of the world. You just sort of get used to it not raining.
Mm. Tell us about Sea Buckthorn as well. Sea Buckthorn sounds like the name of a racehorse, but what is it? Because a lot of people won't have heard of it. I hadn't heard of it till I talked to you about it.
Yeah, well, Sea Buckthorn is, so it's a perennial crop, first to start off with. It's our sort of main diversified crop, if you like. Mm-hmm. And it's a bright orange berry, which is what we harvest it for, and it has a silvery gray leaf. It growing in the wild is quite a spiny shrub, but all the varieties that we grow are spineless, which is very handy. It's well known really as for its health benefit. Really. Okay. So it has up to sort of 10 times the amount of vitamin C than an orange, which is sort of one of those stats that rolls off
wow,
the tongue.
Was it 10 times? Wow.
10 times. And there's 188 different bionutrients within it. So that was one of the things that really grabbed us with, I suppose, markets moving towards health, well-being, that kind of thing.
So how did you first come across it?
So the backstory behind all this is the fact we're a really low-lying farm, bang on the Essex coast, about half the farm. So we grow about 160 hectares of cereals, and there's about another 140 hectares worth of grass, permanent pasture, marshland, that kind of thing. Over half of that is below sea level. And in the long, long term, even though, as everyone reminds me, this is not really an issue right now, but we're thinking for the long term, mm-hmm. That is a long-term threat from sea level rise. Mm-hmm. So the way we're trying to think as a business is to be resilient in that longer term. So we've got to think about being profitable on a much smaller acreage. And therefore, we were looking at a range of crops that could be more profitable, and that means sometimes looking outside the box. In the mid 2000s, we were looking at a range of different crops, working with the then InCrops Enterprise Hub at the University of East Anglia, and there were about, I don't know, probably about 30-40 alternative crops on that list, and sea buckthorn was on that list, and it stood out really, number one, because of its range of potential products. Mm-hmm. The fact it was a perennial crop, which is something that we were interested in, and in theory it was a good thing to be growing by the coast, although we didn't really know much about it at the time, and it was a bit of a learning curve. I mean, it's grown across the northern hemisphere, mostly big in Russia, the mate, they've been growing it since the 20s. Okay. And they have a range of different varieties, and the Germans in Europe are sort of the leaders of that. I mean, and then the Chinese grow more sea buckthorn than we grow of wheat in this country. Wow, so it's on a big scale there. Yeah. So there was a knowledge base out there, but in terms of the UK, there's zero knowledge of the agronomy, and there's pretty much zero market. So who would be mad enough to take something on like that?
So is it difficult to grow it as well, or is it quite an easy crop if you've got the right location?
We thought it was going to be easy, which was another reason for putting it in. But like anything, I suppose you just get used to it as you go on, and that's been, for me, that's been one of the brilliant things. It's been every year that's gone by, it's been a learning curve. But challenges wise, I mean, yeah, within the first 2-3 years of them going in, we lost 40% of the crop to disease. Mm-hmm. And just generally not adapting, but the 60% that remained got stronger and stronger, and even learning things like pollination. We get about a six to ten day period at the end of March, which is absolutely critical for pollination. If you miss that, then you don't get a crop at all, which we have experienced in a couple of years. And for some reason in Essex, we seem to get very strong winds, so it's wind pollinated round about the last week of March. That always seems to happen.
Okay.
So it's been a learning curve with that, and then of course, so that's on the growing side, and then on the market side, huge learning curves in terms of how you take something that no one has heard of,
yeah,
and build that. And that's been, for me, I've weirdly learned a lot from podcasting.
Okay.
To push down that line, because
yeah, okay,
the line we're taking with sea buckthorn is that this is all about community, and we have, yep, a sort of a health community, and a community of people who are starting to use sea buckthorn in a big way.
Yeah.
And it's grown on word of mouth a lot. Chefs are increasingly interested in it. It's quite a chefy thing.
Okay.
And it makes an amazing sorbet, for example, absolutely brilliant sorbet. So it's early days, but we've always seen this as a 20-year project.
So if anyone's listening and they want to find out a bit more about it, where can they look?
I'm glad you asked that, Will. you can check out our website, which is britishseabuckthorn.com. There's enough information on there, but also and on Twitter or Facebook, we're at British Sea Buck.
Tell us about the farm growing up, because the farm has changed immensely from when you were a kid to what it is now. Tell us a bit about those early days.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, in many ways, yeah, I'm absolutely amazed that I'm here talking to you and have been involved in this world, because it has changed that much. But so my dad was a third generation dairy farmer, milking up until mid-90s, round about, I think it was around about 120 to 150 head. Mm-hmm. Milking two, sometimes three times a day. My memories as a child with all I didn't see so much of that stress. Mm-hmm. Which clearly my parents, mum and dad, had to deal with. It must have been a really, really just
mid to late 90s was very difficult time for dairy, yeah, farms, wasn't it? I remember very clearly that being a difficult time for my parents as well.
Yeah. So yeah, so the bulk of the herd was sold 97-98, but dad kept some going, and I think it was ultimately got got out of the industry in 2001. And I mean, there was the debt was immense. And I think it's an absolute miracle in many ways that he managed to keep it going. But sold practically all the machinery. The farm in essence then shifted into mostly an arable farm to start with, larger acreage, which was contracted out to local farm, which is part of the Century Farming Group. And then again shifted. So as stewardship schemes came in, I think Dad saw that as a good means of sort of stabilizing things, because that was really all that time was. It was about survival, mm-hmm. And whatever we can do just to buy a bit of time and keep the bank on side.
Were you aware of all this at the time, or really, or because when you're a child and your parents going through things like this, you're not always that aware of it, are you?
I think certainly in the early days, because I was like, 7, 8, 9, when the cows left, you still have that general idea that something ain't right here.
Yeah.
My mum was incredibly strong during that whole time, and I think she must have just done a very good job with me and my sister of keeping us out of all that stress. Because I don't have much recollection of being involved in that per se, but I do definitely remember when the cows went and all of a sudden, there's something up here. But yeah, again, moving through my teenage years, it was, I pretty much grew up through that, thinking that the farm wasn't going to be here really in many ways. And, or certainly that it was a very different place to how I might have sort of thought I might be involved in it. I think in my head, I sort of moved away from farming in many ways. And I saw, I'd seen what the business had done to Dad personally. And I saw how much stress it was creating again in those, as I sort of grew up through that. I think it set a scene for, exploring lots of other things, which is perhaps in hindsight, which one thing I'm terrible at, as you know, is that I'm very good at wanting to do lots of stuff, or maybe very bad at I'm getting better at saying no to things, but I'm still very bad at myself of not coming up with new projects. I think that might have been born around at that time.
Tell me about music, Ben. You are very, very musical. How did that start?
Well, I think it might be part of the same thing, really.
Yeah.
In that music for me, especially playing music, whether that's piano, I'm a very bad guitarist, as my brother will attest to, but it's gradually getting better, maybe. But whatever that is, it's my little escape from the world, I suppose. And when I'm playing, I just sort of, I go into a zone that I can just escape from anything. And that started, that started from quite a young age. No one really in my, there's no real sort of background of music
there
at
isn't.
All.
I was going to ask you, were you a musical family? No.
I just have loads of memories of Simply Red is the only musical memory I have from being a child, because it was just played. They were played all the time, My mum's obsession, definitely, still is. Oh my goodness. Anyway, listening and playing and just exploring all sorts of genres through my teenage years and beyond as well. It's been really, really important to me, and definitely. I mean, it was a big part of when I was at school and getting involved and friends and exploring new ideas and sort of. And definitely, I did. And I mean. I even considered, sort of, as my brother has actually now, interestingly, going into music, which I never really know what that means, but certainly music becoming your life, as it were. But for me, there was that thought process, and I remember going, sort of having that conversation with myself, that it would change it slightly, and it would change that experience, and it might not, but in my mind, it would remove that ability to, it's my little escape from the mm-hmm. world, which it always has been.
Yeah.
So still is.
So which, I mean, you play several different instruments. Is piano your favorite? Is that the main?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And that's, I suppose it's mainly just the thing. It's the place where I feel most comfortable.
Yeah.
I would say in a weird sort of way.
Do you ever stand on the stool and give it a bit of Jerry Lee Lewis? Great Balls of Fire.
Oh my God. Yeah, maybe now. I would.
Have you always been a good writer? Have you always been quite literary? Is that the word? Literary? I don't know.
I don't know. That's wrong with it.
Have you always been a good writer?
I don't know. Again, I've always enjoyed. Yeah, I've always enjoyed the idea of, I suppose, storytelling as a child. And again, me and my best mate sort of living in a bit of a world of our own. Mm-hmm. We'd always do lots of made up a lot of stuff and lived in our own heads a bit. I suppose that imaginative aspect. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed, and I mean, a lot of books when I was a kid, which were mostly all connected with farming in some way. Dick King Smith was a big influence on me.
Yeah.
Ace, Sophie stories, all that sort of line. I suppose it was that accessing a different world, which, again, is something that we can do as podcasters. It's that amazing insight into something that's not your own lived experience. Being able to translate that in some way. So I suppose, yeah, the reading definitely came first, and then it was this matter of putting it down in some way. I suppose I was a bit of a weird teenager, in that, especially as a weird teenage boy, in that I kept a diary, which was a bit weird. It was a bit strange, but it's like, this is great. And I have not read any of those early entries. Well, goodness knows what they want to
do. All teenage boys are weird, though, aren't they? There's no such thing as a non-weird teenage boy. I mean, that's,
it's such an odd time. Yeah. Such an odd time.
Yeah.
I would say I've enjoyed writing for quite a while. But at the same time, I will also go through periods where I won't want to have anything to do with it. And it sort of becomes, when writing becomes a stress, it's not, it's not worth doing.
No. So, at uni, you got quite into, conservation, wildlife, all that kind of, jazz, which is obviously a big thing these days, but then perhaps wasn't so much. So where did that love come from?
I suppose it was, I was really interested in this idea of, I was studying environmental history. That was my main focus. Mm-hmm. And it was a real sort of way of me getting back into the countryside, I suppose, and really learning in all sorts of ways about soil and the land and lots of sort of geographical stuff. And the conservation group was there as a thing, and that sort of provided a means of going out, and we did we went and volunteered with National Trust and Avon Wildlife Trust and Gloucestershire Wildlife Trust, and we had trips to North Wales and all over the place. It was really fantastic. And just gaining general sort of practical conservation skills. That was there for, I started with them in my first year, and then ended up being the president, which I think that sounds ridiculous, but for university societies. But yeah, so I led it when I was in my final year. Wow. And that was a great experience in itself as well. The end, we managed to take over, which I'm amazed the university allowed that, but I think it was a 10-12 acre woodland, which became the conservation group's sort of new responsibility to manage, which was really exciting, actually. And they're still doing that today, which is really, really good.
That's really cool. So at that time, were you, when you were involved with sort of the conservation group and you were doing that stuff, were you ever thinking, well, look, perhaps I could take this back to the farm? Is this, something I could do on a spare corner of a field or anything like that? Were you, I guess that's where the seed of the idea was beginning to form, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, this was really the period where I really started, like I say, I wanted to explore the countryside, the land in all its ways. So I spent certainly all my uni summers and a couple of Easters as well, just lambing seasons, all out on farms, all over the place, really. I met some amazing people who are still really firm friends to this day. So I did a couple of lambing seasons in Scotland, worked on mixed farms up in southwest Scotland, Herefordshire. Spent a couple of weeks on a goat dairy farm in Somerset. That was an interesting experience.
Oh, but it was.
That was fantastic, actually. Oddly, working with sheep, particularly, which a lot of people listening to this will think, really? why? But that was it got the bug back in me. I did, definitely at that stage, I wasn't thinking, well, yeah, I'll go back home or I'll start a career in agriculture. So I think my thinking, if anything, was to go into conservation at that point. But I was still, because of the way that I am, I was still trying to keep a sort of an open mind and see what I'm actually doing. So it wasn't until I'd left Bristol and I mean, talk about being at the right place at the right time. So I had my sister, who did, she's an artist and she worked at an art gallery fairly locally to here in Essex. It's a big, amazing, great big 18th century tower, old building, fantastic. And her boss had a call from someone at Essex Wildlife Trust because they wanted to build an education centre on the reserve where the art gallery is based, and they wanted someone who Michelle, the owner of the tower, could work with, so this is available, apply for the job in essence. Still thinking at that stage, I've got the bit of experience I've done through volunteering wise for a few years, still. This is my first conservation job that I've applied for.
Yeah.
Don't know who else has applied for it. But the interview went pretty well and thought, okay, well, we'll see. Got the job. And that was sort of my first foray into conservation. And that was a massive learning curve in terms of PR, I suppose, apart from anything else. I was then... I was a little bit older because I started uni after a few years because it takes me ages to start anything. So I think I was, 20? I must be mid-20s or so.
Yeah.
At that point. It was a great experience in terms of working with people and trying to understand, I suppose the nuances of people and why people get upset about stuff, bringing people on side, realizing that actually yeah, someone might say something but actually mean something completely different. And yeah, I suppose trying to team building, building a team, had some amazing volunteers, absolutely fantastic volunteers on my team around about that time. And I'm working with the local community.
Thing is, it's really interesting because I didn't really do anything like that. I left school and came straight into the farm because I hated school. And then later, much like you, I went to uni. I think I was 20, 21 when I went. And that was real. And then I came straight home to the farm again. But now I regret it. I wish I had gone off and done for at least for a year or two, something like that with people and learn how to, I don't know, just be in different situations, I suppose. And perhaps with, dare I say it, with non-farming situation, you know, just that, I think I would have learned a lot from it.
But so that one of the things that just amazes me about sort of with you saying that now, because again, because you are so good with people, you really are. Where does that come from? That's me asking you a question.
I don't know whether I wouldn't have said I am, though. I mean, I've sort of over the last few years I've had to learn to be, I guess. It's all bullshit, man. I'm crap with people, really. It's all a front.
Same. Sorry.
When I turn the podcast microphone on, it's like a flip switch, switch flips, and I'm just really grumpy and horrible, really.
It is a weird thing that happens though when a microphone is there, though, isn't it? You do have to.
Your inner lovey comes out.
Learn about it. Anyway, so I'm going off topic again.
So, how did you get from there? And from working, I guess you obviously were enjoying it. You'd obviously kind of settled in and enjoying the job and enjoying meeting new people. So how did you get from there to being back on the family farm?
Through all that time as well, I was heavily involved with a national youth group called A Focus on Nature, which in essence, it's a bit like Young Farmers for Conservationists, in essence, sort of. Great fun as well. So I was quite involved in that. So I was thinking, where am I going after this? And I was trying to balance all these things. And again, heritage and history was still, I wanted to have an aspect of that in there.
Yeah.
So the National Trust sort of stood out really as an organization that represented a lot of things that I was interested in or had skills in. Sent some speculative applications off. And a brilliant man called Paul Hawkins down in the southwest lot of the National Trust got in touch with me, and we had a really long chat on the phone about everything in a completely random way. In essence, he sort of asked me, we'll put a project together and we'll try and get some funding and see where we go. Because we thought, right, well, we need some money. Who has some money? Well, academics tend to have sort of sources of money. So let's get an academic involved. So I pleaded back to one of my tutors at Bristol, Professor Peter Coates, who is just one of the most brilliant men I've ever met in my life. He was a massive influence. Peter, if you are listening, hello. So he sort of joined our team. And we wanted, so my idea broadly was to, right, okay, so the National Trust have properties and they tell the history of those properties really, really well. Mm-hmm. But what about the history of the landscape?
Yeah.
The history of the environment, the history of the landscape, how can we do that? Which is like a massive thing, like a huge, huge thing. And there's no way in a small project where I think we had it was definitely less than £10,000. Anyway, it was a fairly small amount of money for what we wanted to do to start with. And so that was the general theme. It was all very vague. We got some funding from the Brigstow Institute to do a sort of case study. And we looked at different properties and the Honeycutt Estate in Exmoor. It seemed an obvious place to try and explore the idea of how you A, research the history of that landscape, and then B, get the public involved and the local community in some ways in owning that story, yeah, really, and telling that story, and ultimately bringing a bit more money into the rural economy, sort of diversifying that tourist approach, which is a lot of the stuff that I'd, and I dabbled with this when I was at Essex, which my boss at the time didn't know about most of the time. I just sort of did my own thing and organized events and things, and then yeah, said, oh, sorry, did I not tell you about that? So yeah, I had a very happy time at Honeycutt. Brilliant team there, fantastic conservation team, brilliant load of rangers, and yeah, got involved in all departments, did some research at the Exmoor archives and Somerset archives, and so it was about, yeah, taking the history, the ecology, that was probably my first lot of interviews, actually, now I think of it. That was when, because I had to, yeah, which I was really bad about and I was really nervous about at the time, was interviewing pretty much everyone on the estate. That's right the way through from people who live there,
yeah,
to the management, to the rangers, to the farmers, a whole range of people. And I had to just interview them about sort of what they thought was special about the place, their links with the place. And the more I did, the more I really loved that. It's a really, really brilliant thing. I had a happy time, and the project was a success. And we kept the funders happy. And then there was the question of where we go from there. We put in a funding application, but nothing really happened. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, right, okay, just to cover myself, I better be applying for other things. I suppose it was a period when I just came across lots and lots and lots of hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fine for the first few months. And I managed to, so I then did some odd bits of work. I did some transcription work for the BBC and other little bits and pieces, just to sort of, yeah, get some money in. But yeah, as I had an interview, I then had, yeah, then got a rejection from that. I then had another interview, then got a rejection from that. I even applied to DEFRA, which
did
is...
Did you?
I could have ended up working for DEFRA. Can you imagine? I would be terrible working for DEFRA. Oh my goodness! They made the absolute best decision not giving me that job.
I don't know, Ben. You couldn't be, you couldn't be any worse than what's there at the moment.
Oh no! I think I'm way too much of a maverick. Definitely. Oh, it would have been a nightmare. But no. So anyway, yeah, I just went through a really, really sort of strange period, and that hit my confidence.
Mm-hmm.
It hit my confidence big time without really knowing that at the time.
Yeah.
It's one of the strange things about mental health. That it does creep up on you.
Oh, yeah.
But back then I didn't even know it was a thing. I'd just been living my life for years, just having project after project after project and pressure. And I love pressure. Mm-hmm. I need stress in my life. Mm-hmm. I've come to realize that.
Yeah.
And I need to be pushing myself, but it is a balance. And yeah, that particular time, that was another thing that happened at that time. I had a book proposal in with a publisher, which was getting along the line. And it was a particular day when I'd been up to London for a job interview. I think I was about three or four stages into that. And then the day after that, so I got a rejection from there. I got the book was rejected. There were a number of other things that were happening at the same time. I'd recently, moved out of my house, and I'd moved in with my girlfriend at the time then. And it just hit me. I burst into tears. That was the first time I'd cried in ages. I couldn't even remember when I cried before then.
Yeah.
I was just, it was not a good time. I knew that something had to change. It was, but I didn't know what, and I didn't know how. And so I'm incredibly fortunate to have a really, really close family.
Yeah.
I mean, we are super, super close as a family, always have been and always will be. And so I went home to the family farm, with no sort of idea of what to do, other than I just needed to get through what I was going through at the time.
I speak to a lot of people about mental health for the podcast, and I know you do as well. And
yeah.
I think that is one of the things and I'm always sort of slightly nervous about talking about mental health, just because, as you said, every case is different. But the main thing that people do seem to say is it does just take them by surprise. And I know it took me by surprise last year. It does just sometimes absolutely blindside you. You're kind of going along all quite fast, then you know where you're going, and you're going along 100 mile an hour, and suddenly it just sort of sideswipes you, and you don't know kind of who you are anymore. And then it takes quite a long time to come to terms with it, I think.
Yeah, no, big time. And I think the other thing which a lot of people I speak to raise again is that it's something that it creeps up on you, but it can also creep back up on you as well.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably the mistake that I made when I went through this for the first time, was that I thought, okay, I'll get through this. I'll come out the other side and it won't be a problem ever again.
Yeah.
and then just go back to my life before of moving at a million miles an hour and trying to be Superman and doing everything. And that first time was not good. I got to a very, very dark place.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved back to Essex. And during all this time as well, my relationship broke down, which is perhaps, I completely understand why that happened. I must have been, I was not an easy person to be around at that time, and it was a lot of stress. But it was, in many ways, it was the farm it was the farm and running, which we'll get onto. But it was the farm that gave me some focus.
Yeah.
And Dad was absolutely brilliant during that whole time. Some days there were some days when I couldn't do anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other days where even if you just, go out and, I don't know, do a bit of topping or something.
Yeah.
That was my success for the day. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. That's a little achievement. And then, move on. And gradually just sort of started taking on a bit more responsibility and doing other tasks.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the great things I find about farming is that you've got a lot of these tasks that you can see what you've done afterwards. So you've got that sense of achievement. And you've got that sort of sense of responsibility as well, which can be a stress, but also it can be a good thing as well.
Yeah, no, I totally understand what you mean with that, and it's partly perhaps the outdoors aspect of it as well, isn't it, and the sort of nature aspect. Although, having said that, one of the things I noticed last year, and funnily enough, I was only saying this to my dad about it today, when I was at my lowest last year, I stopped enjoying the things that I usually enjoy. So the little things on the farm that I would notice, or little jobs I would do that I would really enjoy, I just stopped enjoying them. They'd become a chore, and I wasn't taking any joy from them, the little things that in life that you should take joy from. And now I am again. Just silly little things, and I suppose that was one of the things for me. But
I completely get that. And that was because the second time this happened, the second time it sort of crept up on me. So that's sort of moving forward a bit. I had since got into I think we bought 140, 150 mule ewes. Mm-hmm. And because, yeah, sheep is something that I'd enjoyed doing before, and I enjoy working with sheep. And we went through a very difficult lambing season. But the sheep again was something that it was a responsibility. Mm-hmm. It was something that I had to go out and do. I had to go out and check them. And it was all part of, I suppose, that moving forward process. The fact I was trying to do a million one thing, other things at the same time, because I started, again, I was then in the mindset of, okay, I'm moving on from that. I can start taking on other things again.
Yeah.
I mean, the podcast was all going on through that time as well. That had already started. I was still doing some, sort of freelance bits of writing. What else was going on during that time? Loads of volunteering. Oh my goodness. I was an absolute sucker for saying no to things back then. Oh, right the way through from, I was still doing, lots of conservation stuff, local ag shows, just local community stuff.
You seem to be, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but you and I have got to know each other a bit over the last year or two, and we've got quite a lot in common. And one thing I would say that we do have in common as well, because that's something that I do, I'm rubbish at saying no to things, because generally I like helping people, and I'm a people pleaser. Yeah. I like the people around me to be happy, and I care about, I care about them, so I tend to say yes, but then I can end up very quickly taking up on too much, and then it drags me down.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying, I guess?
Yeah, big time. And that's something that I have made myself become much better at quite recently. Yeah. I would say in the last sort of couple of years or so.
Yes.
Because if you get like that, then you're no good for anyone, and you're definitely no good for yourself.
Yeah.
But it is something that you have to learn, especially, or you have to maybe unlearn. Because it's something you've been doing for so many years before.
How did running help you?
Yeah, so through all that time as well, I mean, running's always been there in my life as well, actually, right the way through to, I was one of those strange kids that actually enjoyed cross country. And
yeah, me too.
Actually willingly went out on runs. So it's always been there as a thing for me, but perhaps in... after I left school, and so between the ages, it maybe 18 and got back into a bit when I was at uni, but less so. I sort of got out of it as a thing, but it was one of the things I made myself do when I was in my lowest ebb.
Yeah.
Because again, it's about routine. It's about progress. Mm-hmm. That's all you need to do is just run. if you go for a mile, if you go for 2 miles, if you go 3 miles, and you can gradually see that progression. And that was a big thing for me, but also it was a reminder again of that combination of physical health and mental health. I've never been sort of an unfit guy, and definitely been active in many ways. I'm very active, but you can always improve. And for me, it was almost more about that. I will go out and do this. And it was something that I could still do. So that's how it began.
Mm-hmm.
Signed up for 10Ks and half marathon and all that sort of stuff, which again was something to aim for.
Mm-hmm.
That was really, really good. And then I was approached quite out of the blue, weirdly, through C. Buckthorn, actually, but that's another story, by a couple of local guys who had an idea to open like an outdoor gym, sort of outdoor fitness wellbeing center. They'd approached a few other farms sort of in the area. Mm-hmm. Because everyone is very sensible around here, everyone said no.
Everybody said, it's not for me, but I know a man who it will be for.
Funny that, yeah. It's pretty much exactly what happened. So, why don't you approach the Eagles? Yeah, they'll do something like that. So we got talking, and to start with, I mean, we were literally just going to rent them some land and they were going to crack on with it. But the more I got to know them, this is Andy and Stephen, we realized that we had a click between the three of us, and there was something that worked here, and so we knew we're going to start off with an event. And one thing I'm really, really I hate the word passionate, so I'm not going to use that word, one thing I really want to push more is this combination between definitely telling the farming story in many ways, but getting people onto farms.
Yeah.
If we can't get people, if we can't actually employ lots of people directly on farms, well, let's get people onto farms in other ways. An event is a great way of doing that. Mm-hmm. So we thought, right, we're going to do a mud run, which we did last September. It was probably the driest mud run that I've ever experienced in my life. We had bits of blue pipe going all over the place, which was put down very, very last minute. My goodness, that was done last. That was the week before. It was absolutely insane.
To be fair, I've done a few of those runs. I've done a couple of tough mudders and things like that, and it's always struck me how much work and organisation must go into them. To be fair,
we were so naive. Or certainly, yeah. I was incredibly naive. Sort of the story of my life, I suppose. It was a great experience, and definitely for this year, it's if anyone wants to come, by the way, it's on September the 5th, Muddy Fun Run. Hopefully, again, if COVID allows.
Hopefully people won't have to social distance. It's difficult in a mud run.
I was thinking about that today, so how is that going to work? Hopefully this year will run a lot easier. But a few months ago, before that, to sort of keep the story going, we thought, right, so we've got this event coming. Again, we have no marketing budget. Again, story of my life. So how do we get people involved? Well, again, let's work on this community aspect, which again was something that I took from podcasting. And we thought, well, park runs a thing. And people seem to like that, but why don't we get people involved on the farm here? So Farm Runner was born. And it was very, very simple. We created a 5K route across the farm, and there was a shorter one, so 2.5K. And it was very, very simple. You come along on a Sunday morning at 8:30, and you run, walk, or jog the course. And at the end, we all meet up. And you have a chat, get to know your local community, and you do that on a regular basis. We started on July the 3rd, I think it was, last year. It was just me, Andy, and Stephen. But I think it was just me and Stephen, actually. I'm not sure Andy came to that first one. He must have done. And week after, I think we had one person came along. So we had a Facebook page. With hardly any followers at that point, but we sort of put out this thing. This is a general idea. Please come along. And yeah, it was Diane, I think, who came along at the first one. And then the week after, we had, I think, there were four or five people. And then the week after, then it doubled sort of week on week, right the way up to sort of within 6 weeks, we were up to, I think, around about 60 people. All regularly meeting, and there was this real buzz behind it. But at the same time, we thought, right, okay, let's take this wider, because again, for me, what was really important was as you know, isolation is a massive thing in farming, and at the same time, something farmers are actually pretty good at, or some farmers, is social media. So let's think of a way of actually connecting farmers and getting other people involved in other parts of the country. So the hashtag farmrunner was born, and I put out a tweet and made a little video and said, in essence, what we're trying to do. And I was just I mean, yeah, it was amazing response, yeah, including from your good self, of course. we started seeing farmers all over the country, from Buckinghamshire to Devon to Lincolnshire to North Wales to Scotland, and not just farmers as well. I mean, lots of vets. We've got a big cohort of vets up in Scotland now, which is great. All based on. And what's been really, really interesting for me as well has been I was hoping this was going to happen, but it's been a way of giving another way of people for telling their own story, and saying what's going on their farms, what's happening, and that's been and connecting with each other, but feeling part of something bigger as well. We've got some big plans for the next. Well, we had big plans for during COVID, then COVID happened, I'm hoping to push it further post COVID.
COVID, even pre COVID, I suppose. There's been an awful lot of discussion over the last few years about food and fitness and problems in our society with cheap processed food and obesity and the pressure on the National Health Service. And there's been talk a lot in the new with the new UK ag policy, how they can do something about that. Something like this is kind of on the zeitgeist with that, I suppose, as well, isn't it? It's just sort of, again, just pushing, reconnecting that idea of healthy food, healthy body, healthy mind, I guess.
Yeah, big time. And certainly, I mean, it's something that UK chefs, I mean, Jamie Oliver's comes to mind, have been very good at. Actually, I mean, I remember one of the very early episodes of Meet the Farmers was with Paul Kelly, who's a turkey farmer near Chelmsford in Essex, mm-hmm. Who is he's a genius at the marketing game and connecting with that TV chef brigade. Mm-hmm. And they have actually, I don't think that it's something that I personally want to explore more is this connection between, which sounds so obvious, but it's that connection between food and farming. That I don't think we as an industry we do nearly enough of actually reaching out to connected sectors.
Couldn't agree more.
And helping helping each other to tell each other's stories, because in essence we're all doing the same thing. We're all connected to this brilliant thing, which is brand Great British Food.
Well, that's exactly what we're trying to do with Eat Farm Now, as you know.
Exactly, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I've sort of long said that if you went down the street and asked 100 people what's the first thing they thought of if you said food, most of them would say a supermarket or a celebrity chef before they would say a farmer. And I think I think that's what we need to change.
So, Ben, Meet the Farmers podcast. We've gone long enough without talking about it. How did it come about? How did you initially come up with the idea for it?
Yeah, so I was living in Bristol, and I was in one of my favourite pubs in Bristol, in Cottam. One of the things I love about Bristolians especially is that Bristol is one of those places where there are still lots of pubs there where you can still go into the pub, not know anyone at all, and just have a conversation with whoever's there. And that particular day, I think there was a real mix of people there, right the way through from, sort of plumber, teacher, people who worked in IT. It was just, a real mix. And I don't know how it happened, but the conversation moved to food and then farming, and I wasn't very there were some friends of mine in that group as well, and I think what one of them must have brought up that Ben's dad's a farmer, he grew up on a farm, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And everyone was really fascinated in a sort of way that, well, this is why this is surely some of these questions are really sort of why would you find this interesting, in the way that I was thinking at the time. And podcasts at that time, because I've just as I'm sure you find as well, it's just amazing. It is absolutely amazing what has happened in the world of podcasts.
Oh, unbelievable!
In such a short amount of time,
unbelievable.
But even then, it was because I think I think you must have started rock and roll farming around about the same sort of time. Was it 16, 17?
Yeah, early 17.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, so we're sort of talking about podcasting and farming, and they say, well, surely this is a great way of giving farmers more of a voice. I find that really interesting that we must have had a very similar idea. Yeah. Around, but how did it start for you? Because I don't think I must have asked you that when I interviewed you, but I can't remember.
Well, I stole the idea from Rob Sharkey.
Of course,
because I'd heard Rob's podcast, and I just thought, well, this is great. There's this in America, and he's really sort of breaking new ground when it comes to farming or communicating from agriculture. And I thought, well, why isn't the one here? Because you know, you and I must, as we just said, we must have been talking about it at the same time.
Yeah.
And I thought, why isn't there one here? Well, I better do it before someone else does it. And that was about the extent of the thought I put into it.
That is fascinating. Yeah, because I didn't even know that his podcast existed before I'd had that conversation. I came to that as a result of starting Meet the Farmer. And all of a sudden was, oh, well, they are happening. Why do I need to do this? Oh my goodness, I was so bad in those early days. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, but then gradually, bit by bit, you do sort of just get, it becomes to a part of a new normal. And I honestly can't imagine life now without Meet the Farmers.
Yeah.
I just can't.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? How you know, you and I have talked about it before, but you, as you said earlier, actually, you just get the chance to speak to so many interesting people that normally you just would not get the chance to talk to, and have an hour long conversation with them. And it's rare that any of us do that anymore. Anyway, sit down and have a one on one hour long conversation with people, isn't it? You know, it feels like such a privilege to get that opportunity, I think.
That is such a good point, because actually, even with people who we're really close with, or people we've known for ages, you still really have the kinds of conversations or ask the sort of questions that that you sort of ask when you're a podcast host. It's strange.
Yeah. What do you like best about it? What's your favorite? Is it that, I guess?
It's definitely meeting people from all over the place. So there is no way that you would ever come into contact with otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now, one of the reasons that I started mine as well, though, was I was quite frustrated at the time with the way the farming industry communicated with its consumers. So I was thinking, there's all this sort of digital space, and the farming industry, which is quite conservative with a small c and quite traditional, why aren't they in it? And why aren't they doing more? Why aren't the farming organizations doing podcasts? Or why aren't they on YouTube? So a lot of mine was just sort of born out of frustration. But do you think that in the last 3 or 4 years since we started doing the podcast, that as an industry we have got better? Because I think we have. I think we've vastly improved.
I mean, because one of the things that I have found interesting in terms of sort of identity, in terms of communication, or sort of the world of communications where podcasts sit, I find it bizarre when I've been to places like the Oxford Farming Conference, and I've been given access to the media room, which I feel such a fraud in. And I remember I was sitting behind Charlotte Smith. And I just want to just die now because I should not be here. But I think you have to sort of have to think about podcasting in itself. It is a medium, and it's a medium that's here to stay, and it is growing. And I think there's 6 million listeners of podcasts generally in the UK, and that's a growing number. And it's just a fantastic way of communication and being, and a very intimate way of approaching listeners. And you can have brilliant conversations. I think it's changed in a few ways over the last few years. Number one is There are far more podcasts. That's probably the obvious thing to say.
There's about 20 farming ones sprung up over the last 2 months.
Okay, let's list them off. So, Farmers Guardian, Stud One, Farmers Weekly. Although, being fair, Johan, you have had it going for quite a while, so that's fine. I mean, there are some long-standing ones. I mean, like Farmarama, which is like a small-scale organic one that's been going quite a while.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah, there's been a real massive rise in the last, which is great.
It is great
in so many ways. I just wish
that
I had the time to listen to them all.
Yeah, well, me too.
But I think a lot, and I mean, I know, yeah, I know you listen to a lot of podcasts, but so I'd be interested in hear your view on it as well. But I think podcast hosts, and that's massive generalization, but have become more open themselves. Perhaps, I mean, it obviously depends on the show and their role within it. But I feel as a host that because of the other kinds of podcasts that seem to be starting, and I feel more open about asking questions that are more personal than I would perhaps have done a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I get that impression that I feel okay about that, because it feels like that is the general gist and the general direction that people are going. And that, I think, is one of the wonderful things about podcasts. And I think it's a really, really important thing about podcasts, is that is the space that it works in, and it gives you an insight into a person that you just would not see otherwise. And it always amazes me how you can have a recorded conversation through a microphone with someone, and that conversation goes out to depending on your audience, a few dozens, hundreds, thousands of people, and people are so open, and that's fine, and it's good, and you can have some brilliant conversations.
I couldn't agree more. And as you say, and I sort of jokingly said that there's loads around, but I'd like to see more. Anybody who's, well, I have helped a few people sort of get started with it, and I would help anyone else, because the more there are, the better, really.
Absolutely, no, couldn't agree more. And it's just brilliant that there's more content out there.
Yeah. And it's just, yeah. And also, it's great to see yours now every week, because I'm really enjoying all the sound effects and the little jingles.
Ben Butler did such a great job with those. But no, it took me long enough to get to a weekly format. I think it was just me being lazy. But it does take up
a lot of your time, though, doesn't it?
It does.
It is quite a beast, isn't it? I don't think people quite realise, because it's not just, it's not just this, is it? It's research and emails and editing and the whole shabam. It does kind of take over your life a little bit.
Yeah, but totally worth it at the same time.
Absolutely. All right, then. We're going to have to end it with the quick questions.
What?
Because we've been an hour and three quarters. And I'm supposed to go for a run after this, and it's quarter, it's like 9:20 at night.
I'm so sorry. I've just enjoyed it so much. This has been, honestly.
I'd be quite happy to chat for another hour. But I have got other things to do. So, the big one. What is your all-time favourite song? And I'm really interested in you being a music man.
I spent a long time, as I was sitting on a dumper truck today for my entire day, I had a lot of time to think. And this one took a while, but at the same time, it's by Colin Hay, who used to be with Men at Work.
Okay.
And it's called Beautiful World. And it's one of those songs that's just, I'm a big fan of him anyway.
Yeah.
And that song at various times of my life has just meant a lot. So I'm going for that. Colin Hay, Beautiful World.
I'm going to look that up after I've not heard it. So it's a new one on me. I will. I'll check it out.
Yeah, he's a Scottish Australian.
Okay. All right. What is your favourite podcast? I had to ask you this.
I mean, for Becky's sake, I've got to say the Kite Podcast. Becky, haven't I? But we've got to get a mention of there. But again, I thought about this, and I mean, it's cliched. It's cliched, but it's got to be Joe Rogan.
Yeah, it is unbelievably good, that podcast, isn't it? It just is.
Yeah. I've learned, and I still learn so much from him as an interviewer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's going to have to be that.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. And it's incredible how that's grown. Did I read those? How many million downloads a month he gets?
Must be.
Absolutely incredible. Yeah. Okay.
We can dream.
Well, we're not far off, are we?
Maybe if you combine us, we're not too far off.
What was the last TV series that you binge watched? It's been a big topic of conversation over
The English Game on Netflix.
Is that good? Yeah, I heard it was good.
It's worth watching.
Yeah. Sarah wasn't very keen because it's about football, isn't it?
But it's not that much to do with football. I mean, it is, but
yeah,
it's if you're not massively into your football, then it's still fine.
Okay, I'll tell you said it was good. Okay. If you could interview anyone,
I mean, she definitely won't watch it.
If you could interview anyone in the world for your podcast, doesn't have to be a farmer, but who would it be?
Again, this took a long time, and the conclusion I came to was Lenny Henry.
Lenny Henry, that wasn't what I was expecting.
it wasn't what I was expecting either, but I think he would be absolutely fascinating. Mostly because I know very little about him other than the sort of headline factors.
That's partly what I love about
meeting someone, because then again, it becomes more of a, you uncover layers. And I think he's done so much. The comic relief side, and
yeah, his early comedy was brilliant, and it would be really fascinating actually to find out about the early days of comic relief and getting that off the ground and everything, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and lastly, then the question that people always struggle to answer: what's your favourite agricultural related social media account to follow?
Well, again, it's quite cliched, but I think I'm going for this from the perspective of trying to get a wider audience. Mm-hmm. People perhaps who aren't connected with farming having an insight into it. And I think that one of the best Twitter accounts in this, apart from Meat Farm Now and your good self, of course, is at Farmers of the UK.
That's my answer as well. Yeah, it's just fantastic, isn't it? And sometimes it's always nice, I always think, with Farmers of the UK, when you get someone who perhaps hasn't got a big social media presence, but they just massively embrace it and they really go for it and they really tell the story of their farm. I always think that's just sort of so lovely to see, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Fantastic. Ben, it's been brilliant to finally speak to you.
I speak to you every week, Will.
We do speak every week, but it's been great to speak to you for the podcast.
It's been such an honour, and yeah, just such good fun as well coming on. So no, thank you so, so much.
Wasn't too painful answering questions, was it, being at the receiving end?
It's an absolute joy. The best thing is, I don't have to do the editing.
You don't have to do the editing. I'm going to have to get up about 5 o'clock tomorrow morning to do this. Fantastic. And it's been brilliant. And keep up the good work there, everything you do. I'm really excited to see all the work you're doing with the outdoor gym and everything, and see how that goes. Hopefully COVID will bugger off soon so you can get on with it more. But be really, really good to see where it goes over the next few years. So I will speak to you soon.
Speak to you soon.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening, and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans, this has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.